doing something really different. And through that, the various seminars and the projects that they have initiated, through that, we have also had an impact, as Mark suggests, in lay organizations in the Federation world. And many of the congregations that are represented among the lead fellows have themselves generated grant proposals and programs of a variety of different types, winning lots and lots of support in their own localities. Okay. What I'd like to do today is to, well, actually at Mark's suggestion, to present you with a very, very small encapsulated version of one of the sessions that we have included in our seminars that will give you a taste for what this is about and how it operates. But I must warn you in advance, there's no great harm. That lots and lots of people have read all sorts of management texts and attended seminars and training programs, and they walk away saying, well, I knew all of that, and there's no great insight or wisdom, there's no chidushim in this. And to a certain degree, that's true. The chidush is not so much in what you're going to hear, the chidush is in doing something about it. The chidush is in taking some of it in a systematic fashion, being disciplined enough, and incorporating it on a regular basis into one's style of leadership, into one's style of relationship, into one's style of connection, and so forth. It also requires a very, very small but significant shift in the paradigm, in the model that we use in looking at the shul. And that is to see the shul and the community, among other things, as a large corporate entity. And the rabbi, among other things, not exclusively, but among other things, as a chief executive officer. In addition to all the other things, I know that you're not looking for extra work, but nevertheless, like it or not, these are the roles that you play, and the board members as the board members of any corporation. Does that preclude? I've been sort of criticized for making that suggestion, arguing that instead the model really should be one large, happy family. Does it preclude being a family? Certainly it does not. Some of the largest and most successful corporations are in the business of hospitality and familiarity. Whether you're talking about hotels, or you're talking about tours, or you're talking about a whole variety of leisure industries in which there is a business of feeling comfortable and having fun and being fulfilled and spiritually uplifting, there isn't anything wrong. The models are not part of this ashram. And in an attempt to carry this across, the little magazine that you have in front of you is making the same kind of an appeal, but to boards and lay leadership within the congregation. And we have to start thinking about the quality of what we do. We have to start thinking about the modalities by which we organize. Today's particular session, we have to start thinking of ourselves also as agents of change in a formal kind of sense. Rabbis have always played that role. Every time you give a drasha with the intent of making some sort of a change, whether it's a change in practice, or it's a change in hashkafa, or it's a change in relationship, you're in the business of change. We have formalized some of that in our sessions. The particular session that we're going to do today, very, very briefly, in a very simplified form, talks about what may be one of the building blocks of all of this, and that's relationship. People who do fundraising today, as a formal profession, have generated two very obvious concepts on which they build much of their new approach. Concept number one is relationship, and concept number two is what they call a donor-centered campaign. Both of which are built on a similar idea, that we have to reach out to people, that people have to be taken seriously, that there has to be credibility, and that things don't happen because we yelled at someone or because we sent out a mailing. Things happen on the basis of relationship. Getting to know people, feeling comfortable with them, making them feel that they are part of some sort of an interaction. None of this is new to anybody, and there are Rabbanim sitting here with decades of experience, and it's, I suppose, offensive and presumptuous for me even to be suggesting it. It's so obvious that it goes without saying. My experience is that the thing to go without saying just don't get said very much. So maybe it's a good idea to take a look at it some more. Donor-centered in fundraising means asking people what they want rather than telling them what we think they ought to want. And that's another part of all of this. There are all sorts of critiques. There are all sorts of suggestions as to whether or not that undermines a natural obligation that people ought to feel toward the shul as an institution. What do you mean we're going to ask them what they want? We'll tell them what they should want, and they have to pay for it. And maybe that's 100% accurate and right on the money, and maybe you can find all sorts of Marim HaKamis that will support it. The one that stands on the other side is that increasingly it just doesn't work anymore. That the children and grandchildren of people who are willing to write out checks, as an example, or to come to shul, or to come to conferences, as a matter of belongingness, as a sense of community, as a willingness to be with friends, as an uplifting experience, their grandchildren are seeking those experiences elsewhere and finding them. And that may be the best argument of all. One other caveat. I am not a psychologist. My field of specialization originally was political science, more and more organization and management. Therefore, some of the material we're going to look at today really was hatched and generated within the field of psychology and psychiatry. And for those of you, and I know that there are some of you here who are formally trained in psychology, you're going to find gaps and holes in what we're doing in theoretical terms, in clinical terms. Hatasi avisi pashati, I plead guilty in advance. That's not what this is about. Nor is it your job, it seems to me, to psychoanalyze your membership, even if you are appropriately credentialed. It's not the nature of the relationship. I have the same problem in working with people who trained as clinicians, social workers, and psychologists who move into administrative and organizational positions and still treat their coworkers and their colleagues and the people they supervise, they still treat them as clients and patients. It's a bad idea. Nor are you getting paid enough, frankly, for that. There's a very, very important difference, and that means that what we're going to do now, borrowing from an old set of theories called transactional analysis, is to give you a taste of how you might appropriately maintain a relationship or expand a relationship or analyze a relationship without for a moment suggesting that you are either appropriate or credentialed then to go ahead and do a serious kind of clinical workup. That's the point, even if you are trained in a clinical field, that's probably the point at which you make a referral to someone probably on the outside who will be able to approach all of this in a very objective fashion. It's unfortunate, I find, at least in my own experience, that more and more congregants, many congregants, are seeking professional counseling services from their rabbi, and I don't know if it's fair to the rabbi, and I'm not sure that what he does is necessarily fair to the congregants. At some point, and probably early on, and this is just a sort of a side message, my guess is that that's an appropriate moment for a referral. Let me share some of these with you. And Rabbi Shulman, I have far more than necessary. It's my tendency to overprepare, so you're welcome to take some of these along, and if there's some other use that you can make of them. They make very good kindling, I'm told. Transactional analysis was generated back in the 40s and 50s by a fellow named David Bairn, a psychiatrist trained in family therapy. Forgive me, Eric Bairn, who wrote several books, but the one that made him the most money was called Games People Play, and that was his most popular and least scholarly work, and maybe that's why it made him the most money. And he made a very, very interesting and important assessment in being able to categorize an analogy between all sorts of relationships, thank you, and the family. So if it's true that a model that we ought to use in shul and community is the family, then an awful lot of this fits neatly. He was succeeded by a student named Thomas Harris, who also made a great deal of money in a book called I'm Okay, You're Okay, another psychiatrist. And they, in turn, were succeeded by two ladies that nobody has ever heard of, I don't think, Muriel James and Dorothy Jongwords, who are important for our purposes because what they did was transfer this idea of the family as a model for all relationships, transfer it to the workplace. And in this case, the workplace being the shul, or the boardroom, or the federation, or the community as a corporate, as a large entity. And I ask you just to think about the degree to which that may be intriguing and attractive, that there are many, many analogies. Tell them I'm busy, please. There are many, many analogies that emerge in comparing your relationship with your president, your relationship with the sisterhood, your relationship with the educational director, your relationship with the federation director, as an analogy to familial relationships. That in a family, and in a workplace, and in a shul, and in the community, there are parents, there are angry adolescents, there are babies, there are adults, and that much of the dynamic that you might see with your child is a metaphor of the dynamic that you have with the sisterhood vice president. Or the other way around. Much of the dynamic that you younger rabbis have with the senior board members is not unlike the dynamics that they carry on with their team. Here's a caution. One of the great strengths of transactional analysis as a model of relationship, one of the great strengths is that it's simple to use, it's catchy, it latches on to everyday kind of routine examples. One can capture it in a quick session. One of the great weaknesses of transactional analysis as a model is that it's simple, it's catchy, it uses everyday routine kinds of examples, and you can latch onto it in one quick session. So be forewarned. Its great strength is also its downfall. Bern hypothesized, it's here in front of you. Bern hypothesized that there were three, very Freudian in this sense, three distinct and disparate aspects to the human personality. You've heard all of this now probably on radio talk shows and psychobabble and Oprah. The parent, the adult, and the child. It has entered the lexicon. Three distinct parts of the personality, and they are delineated here on the first pages. The parent is the authoritarian part of the personality. The parent knows. The parent has answers. And that often comes with a certain patronizing element. Not only does the parent know, but it's the parent's job to make sure everybody else knows how much the parent knows. And it's the parent's job to make others feel that they don't know nearly so much. How does one know how to be a parent? We begin early on capturing all sorts of influences in a variety of different modalities from authority figures, including, of course, first and foremost, our own parents, but rebbes, teachers and coaches and older friends, older siblings, and a whole variety of figures who early on have taught us how to be authoritarian. The parent tends to be directed toward the past. I remember the way we did it in Hawaii when I was your age. I used to walk miles in the snow to get to shul on Shabbos morning. What do you mean they can't? What do you mean they don't come to the conference? I remember how it took and how it was difficult for us, but then nothing would keep us. These are parental kinds of references. There's nothing bad about any of this, but it is very characteristic. The parent speaks to the person rather than to the. As soon as you walked in, I knew you were trouble. I could have guessed in a minute that. Oh, him, are you kidding? Why, I remember, and the two go together. Why, I remember what he did in 1968 when we offered him an aliyah and it wasn't shishi. And people who are heavily parental tend to have memories like elephants, and they tend to be locked into this, you know, whatever happens kind of reinforces what they already believed was going to happen, and that makes it appropriate for them to reinvent the past over and over again. But I'd like to note with you item six, parents also, the parental part of the personality, I should say, also tends to be nurturing. Don't worry, we'll work it out, it's okay, it's not so bad, look, we've been through this before, Mela, so you messed up this time, I knew you would mess up, but I also figured out already in advance, right, the Rafu is already ahead of the Maka, so don't worry. There's nothing wrong with having a parental part of one's personality. As a matter of fact, everybody has one. People who work with transactional analysis in the workplace suggest that one should spend probably 20 to 30% of his or her time in the parent, as it were, in the parent ego state. What's a problem, what can be a problem, is when one is locked into the parental state, as an example, locked into any state. We'll talk about the others in a moment. That is to say, people who are always parental, people who are unable to be anything else, people for whom the first and most immediate response in any situation is authoritarian, autocratic, preachy, patronizing. I'm going to need your help. Is there anybody here who knows anyone who is locked in the parent? Anybody here who is, or who admits that you are? Yes, sir. You can think of someone. Anybody else who can pick that image in your mind of what that looks like, what that feels like? You ever work with somebody who's locked in the parent? You just can't be anything else.
Unless you want to speak. This gentleman made a mistake of mine.
You saw the bees, you will have bought the Cezanne for 80,000. This person that you're thinking about, what's it like to work with him? How would you characterize him? Difficult in what way? Yes? Please?
Not open to suggestions. And, generally, you feel like you need to get into
Okay. One more question, and then there are a few others. What do you feel like when you have to work with? No choice, but you have to work with this kind of question. What does it make you feel? Not necessarily. Anybody else who can think of someone who works with someone who has someone in mind, not least of which is a fan. Yes, please?
I think a lot of people have that kind of state.
Yep.
So they're not open to new ideas.
Yep.
They want to show that they, are in control and they know everything.
Power and control is very important, very threatening to hear, to share the opportunity for control. Please.
Possibly sometimes in a person like myself, I feel this is true of myself. It's starting the situation.
Yes.
Then you get a little wiser and try to move away from it.
So very good.
You know what you are, you know where you have to go.
Very good. In fact, you are able to get wiser and change means you're not locked. And that's excellent to hear. Because my very next question, the nastiest question, is there anybody sitting around this room who is locked in the chair? I am. Sometimes we all are. Sometimes there are, and here is a point that speaks to your comment and also to your very wise insight. And that is that there also may be situations and circumstances that draw out the parent in us, even when we don't care to be that way, even when that isn't the way we might be normally. A supervisory relationship might be exactly that kind of experience, where we've kind of made it, or we have, at least the culture has created an environment in which people in supervisory positions think they need to know everything, and think that they need to be on top of everything, and think that no one can ever have some sort of a shared control with it. And it may be that we've created an environment in which people are so tight and so insecure that that's necessary to survive. Are rabbis as a group parental? It might be that we have, and that's, again, that may not be a bad thing per se, as long as it's in control and not locked, but it may be, I'll be using a moment, maybe that we've created a culture in which it is expected that we have to have all the answers, in which it is expected that we treat people in a, an uneven kind of fashion in the relationship to the different.
Is that further treatment? Similar rabbi has said, frustrated, it leads to the next step of angry.
Uh-huh.
So, how could you deal well with anyone coming through anger?
Absolutely.
Another thing you just said, certain things, there is no time. For example, a parent is right there with him, sugar in the ear, that
yep.
He has no time to discuss, so he says, do it.
My way.
Or the highway. He does the same thing you see all the time. Mm-hmm.
We call call it decisiveness. We call it leadership. But the fact of the matter is that those are among the most important, among the resources that one has to invest in order to have the time. There are times when, how do they say, I don't need it good, I need it Tuesday. So, Mela, we make a quick decision, and that's the way it goes, and it's the best that we can until we make a different one. But if nothing else, we ought to derive from that, and this is a whole other lecture, that we have to start thinking about how do I build in the time so that when the next one comes around, I'm not again caught short, and I just have to make a quick decision. I also want to add to the point, I'll be with you, gentlemen, in a moment, to the point that you're making, and it piggybacks on what you're suggesting, and that is that not only can't you work well when you are feeling angry and frustrated, but if you are now the one who is making your board members feel angry and frustrated, or you are the one who is making your congregants feel angry and frustrated because they feel that they are being treated less than appropriately, then don't be surprised if their anger and frustration emerges in their unwillingness or inability to operate functionally within the shul. Rabbi Grauer, if I remember correctly, yes?
How do you account for your generalization of saying that our rabbis tell you that there's a certain assumption on your part?
Absolutely.
And how do you account for that?
It's completely without any scientific support. I'm suggesting, I asked that as a question, but it's a loaded question, a leading question, because it seems to me, not unlike the supervisory relationship we just spoke about a few moments ago, not unlike parental relationships, that we have traditionally created an environment in which, at least formally, rabbis look upon themselves or are thought to look upon themselves as, obviously, centers of authority, and that can very easily lead to that kind of parentalism, which is interestingly turned around either in the relationship of the rabbi with his own teacher, when the Rosh Yeshiva speaks, or in the relationship among younger rabbis towards older board members, older gevirim within the shul, older leaders in the community externally. It can be a very frustrating kind of, personally frustrating and stressful kind of circumstance. I want to push it in another direction to offer some of the alternatives, because I think you will see yourselves in those alternatives in a moment as well. One or two, and then please let me move ahead, Mr. President.
I found over the years that you're saying that your cousins seem accurate, but you also find yourself playing both two roles at the same time.
Uh-huh.
In the relationship, one kind of person you can be one thing, the relationship with somebody else can be something else. Especially if you're a young rabbi trying a new tradition where you come to a community where the average age of the congregants in leadership is about 25 years or senior.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been around for 25
yep.
years,
yep.
and you've always been a good story.
Yep.
Rabbi, of course, this is the way you're doing.
Yep.
This is the way it's always been.
Yep.
And then you have to turn around and say, continue to play with the younger people or
mm-hmm.
the others
mm-hmm.
the same way they're playing with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get sort of get caught in this kind of a vibe.
Mm-hmm. Three quick thoughts that come to mind. Firstly, those are classical parental kinds of instructions. We've always done it this way. Everybody knows that you do it this way. Nobody does it any other way. Parents tend to use terms like nobody and always and every very, very broad and absolute kind of generalizations. Point two, if it is true, as you suggest, and I think often it is, that one has the ability to move from one state to another, from the parent to the adult to the child as circumstances demand, then that may be the healthiest of all personalities. It's the one who's locked in I'm most concerned with. One who can't be or who has great difficulty being anything else. And then finally, let me add just as an aside, I'm reviewing a manuscript for something called the Journal of Religion and Gerontology, in which the study is of Protestant clergy and the question of their experience with the elderly. And what they are saying reminded me of what, at least I remember my own yeshiva training, that for the most part, dealing with older people and the needs of the elderly and gerontology is not something that we confront as a topic, whether early on in our academic career or even into our, even though lots and lots of people, more and more, will be faced early in their career with senior citizens and others who are in leadership positions in the school. So maybe that's something that we ought to think about as a topic as well. One, and then you're going to have to forgive me, please, that I'm going to jump back. Go ahead.
I think it's a question why a person in a synagogue goes into the leadership position. And
you mean a member of the shul?
Mm-hmm.
Lately. Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons probably is the search for the seeking of power. Whatever reason they may have in their first organized, here's an opportunity for them to
be
powerful, to get orders, to have people.
The sublimation.
The rabbi's response, the relationship, is very subjective. First of all, the rabbi is subject to their whims because he wants his job. The job security, I think, is one of the big problems. And unless he's very, very strong, he's going to have a lot of difficulty standing up to this power-hungry person.
One of our objectives in the LEAD program is to develop a sense of self-sufficiency and security, not an overbearing aggressiveness, needless to say, but a sense of willingness to risk and a willingness to take accountability when risks go one way or the other. And I think that's a very important set of skills. The other thing that you're implying, if I read correctly, is that in many organizations, at least with schools and Jewish communities, we have encouraged parental types. We have promoted parental types. People have seen being parental as a route toward leadership. When you look around and take a look at who are the people who are in influence and power, who are the people that have made it, as it were, and so too in many corporations up until very recently, they were people who displayed lots and lots of these kinds of skills, lots of these kinds of personality traits, and therefore it's not surprising that the people they train and mentor and others who use them as a model end up looking very much like the ones before. In that sense, we have a responsibility, I suppose, for those younger cadre of professionals in the field to offer them alternatives. Let me offer one alternative quickly now, and that's on the very next page, and that is the adult. This is the second part of the personality that Baron discusses. People who study transactional analysis as a modality for organizational leadership suggest that one can spend probably about 60 or 70% of their time in the adult. The adult is rational. The adult is calculating, but I mean calculating not in a pejorative sense. I don't mean calculating in a manipulative sense. I mean calculating a cold, thoughtful, cost-benefit analysis of what are the good parts and what are the not-so-good parts and which way will I go on that basis. Almost mathematics. The adult looks toward the future. Not so much, I knew you would screw up, and sure enough you did, but okay, we screwed up, how do we get ourselves out of this? And in that sense, the parent has answers. The adult asks questions. What data is available? What resources are out there? How do we get out of this hole? What are the things that we can do to prevent it from happening again? Those are all adult kinds of questions. Analytic, non-emotional, reflective kinds of questions. Do you know any adults? Have you worked with adults? Just as quiet. It's interesting. Be cautious about categorizing people, certainly not on a first shot. It's very easy and very, very kind of, attractive to say, aha, I know exactly what he's talking about. It's always, interestingly enough, the guy down the hall.
I happen to work with adults. And very good with adults.
Okay, describe it for a minute.
It's just he never loses his cool. He's well planned, well organized.
Yes.
And therefore, even if you look at next person, he's never running into his family problems, professional problems, or his personal problems, and makes it very, very efficient in a very certain situation.
What's it like to work with?
Great.
Because?
Well, because he personally makes everyone around him more efficient.
Good.
And like I said, he doesn't lose his cool. And often for months, it's emergency.
If he treats you like an adult, then what he is doing is encouraging you also. Stay calm, be reflective, plan, and also to be responsive. Things go bad, nobody's going to bail you out. This is not the nurturing parent that's going to pat you on the head and say, don't worry, it's okay. This is the fellow who said, okay, you messed up, now you're going to get out of it. Please.
But he's also very cold.
Good.
Computer.
Okay.
I always thought it was a computer. He just deals with facts.
Okay.
Cold.
Joe Friday.
Mm-hmm. He could be extremely boring.
So you're now describing very, very accurately one who is locked in the adult. You can be locked in the adult as you can be locked in the parent. That's why, again, the suggestion is that one should spend 60 or 70%, 2/3 of the time in the adult, but not exclusively. I pushed the question one step further. Do you know anybody who is lost in the abyss? These are people who never get angry, who never show emotion, who are, what is it, 10-10 wins, all business all the time, who have no other interest. They don't laugh. By the way, the adults are never frivolous. Adults never make jokes. Adults just keep plodding along doing... If you meet somebody on the street that you haven't seen in 2 weeks, and you say hello, and he says, you know that meeting we were at 2 weeks ago? I've been thinking about the budget. It's completely out of context, because that's what this person thinks about. The example they give, which is altogether inappropriate to this audience, the example that Harris gives, the adult, the person locks in the adult, the person goes to the office Christmas party, and sits in the corner and makes out the budget. Okay, these are people who don't relax, who don't know how to have a good time. You're right. Warren. I think the suggestion is that leadership takes more than just purely bland kind of adult characteristics. Let me put it this way. If I had to make a choice that you insisted you must be locked somewhere, then I'd rather you be locked in the adult. But it's still only 2/3 of the answer. Because there are times when it's appropriate to be authoritarian, to be parental. There are times where it's appropriate to give a clap and say, I'm sorry, Hedrick, this is not the way we're going to do it. Officer, you have to do that sometimes. There are times also when one must be nurturing. When saying, I'm sorry, is your problem, how are you going to have it? It may not be a very, very happy or acceptable alternative. Not going to bury you, but it may not be the best one. Ideally, you're going to mix. But if you have to be somewhere, then I guess you ought to be here more than you were. Any other votes in this? We're not going to get, this could be a whole year seminar. We're not going to get to it, but in the analysis of games, among the things that they note is that there is always an ulterior transaction. It is to say, somebody, because it is socially or politically appropriate to be in the adult, then he or she talks one way, but not too deep beneath the surface. There is a sense of, this is what I really want you to do, and you darn well better conform.
Well, they know which way it should go. And they're 100% confident that they know which way it should go. But they are smart enough to involve others and bring them around to what they think.
Okay. Item one, I think that such leaders, let me put it this way, what we're suggesting here doesn't in any way discount your coming in and having a position of your own. The adult is not absent values. The adult is not absent an agenda or a strategy. And especially the healthy adult, which means that he or she is also mixed with parents and child, which we haven't talked about yet, has a whole mix of these things. But is willing to listen and to interact and to draw others in, perhaps only for the reason of co-opting, but you know what happens when you draw others in? You end up changing. You end up listening to what somebody else has to say. You find that there is some room for justice here, that there are alternatives. You end up giving way, even if you don't think it's the best way to do it. The parent never gives way. The parent says, this is the way it's got to be, and it's my way, and it's the end of the game. And you know what? By the way, if you're that way and it works, please, continue. Don't for a moment, I don't think it's going to happen, walk out of here saying, well, Chenault said I should stop doing that, even though I've been successful for the last 35 years, therefore I must do it differently. I don't imagine anybody's going to do that, but if you attempted, then please, if it works, it works. All right, Turner, how much time do you have? Well,
the whole convention is
You wanted to add something.
Yeah, I mentioned before that sometimes when someone's locked into the adult, they say, calculate the extent that they say, it's your problem. You fix it. And I think with the Ravana, I think maybe the adult model is more, because the buck stops at the rabbi, and so this is our problem. Any soul problem, I would imagine, becomes the rabbi's problem.
Uh-huh.
And even as an adult, he says, The adult rabbi said, okay, now we have a problem.
Yes.
So let's fix it instead of maybe just a little nuance.
Fine. And the point is well taken. And an effective leader and an executive officer in any organization cannot say, hey, it's not my problem, you guys are not the problem, because ultimately that person is going to catch heat, even if it wasn't. You know, I am always very, very disturbed with the idea of chief executives being able to get away with things by saying, I didn't know. You needed to know. You should have known. Well, it's those guys at the other end over there. It was Ollie Moore, to say it too, an old thing. Okay? I didn't know what he was doing down there. He was running off on his own. It's your job to know. You need to know. What are we paying you for? That's your, and so too with the rabbi. Like it or not, a lot of stuff gets thrown on your plate that you never dreamt about, that wasn't really what you had meant to happen. And I suppose, you know, the advice the adult might give is, therefore, I got to be on top of a lot of things, and I have to anticipate the kinds of things that are going on, and I have to bring others in so that when it does hit the fan, I'm not left alone. There are others out here who also feel a sense of responsibility and obligation because they were brought in early on. It's not an easy strategy. Let's talk about the child for a minute. The third ego state. The child, which is where the remaining, I don't know, 20% of one's time should be spent in the workplace. The child is emotional. The child is fitful. The child is intuitive. The child plays on hunches. The child is the creative part of the personality. The child is fun by definition. The child likes to have fun. The child is also fickle, changes from moment to moment. Lots of, they say, creative and autistic people have extraordinarily well-developed or perhaps locked children, childlike parts of their personality. It is precisely their creativity, it is precisely their genius in one area or another that requires very little thought, but lots and lots of creativity and intuition and responsiveness that also makes them altogether unable to get their lives together and to keep track of their money and make sure that they don't get into trouble doing silly things. These are the rock stars and the ball players and the politicians who do such incredibly stupid things that anybody with half a mind would understand that there's so much at stake on one hand. Why are you going out and beating up somebody? Why are you getting into trouble? You're making, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and all of a sudden we're going to put you in jail and you're going to have nothing. And you can think of a dozen examples in the last couple of years ago. How could anybody, why do they need a whole entourage, a whole army of managers and attorneys and representatives and agents and hangers-on who are sapping their money for the most part because these people just can't manage on their own. They are locked into the child. You know, in children, it's impossible to be that way with Matthew, but there isn't much. I am hearing a great deal, particularly outside fields about this. So I'm going to take that back. Because I can easily imagine, forgive me, characterizing the kind of thing that is brought into many of your tools under the rubric of the Kalbach movement that is extraordinarily child. Not childish. A lot of the spiritualism that we are reaching toward is speaking to the child part of the personality. Music and dance and togetherness and holy brothers and all of this kind of thing that brings forth an altogether different kind of sensibility, which perhaps is enough to go on its own, but maybe also needs a parent to kind of sit on top of it. Maybe we have been too parental and too adult, and we've kind of ignored the childlike part of the personality.
On the one hand, I'd say it's inspirational and invigorating because you get to see real creative genius. On the other hand, you may be well planned and thought out in advance, and then that sense these fickle kicks in, and your plans are out the window.
You never quite know what you're going to get.
But again, on the other hand, it's it's certainly part of you to maybe be a little more childlike if you're maybe too locked into and well in camp.
A little more hung back, a little more relaxed, a little more, we'll see how it works out. Don't worry about it. Don't be so face-correctant. It's not an easy thing because way back early in most of our careers, we have been taught not to be childlike. And we have been beaten out of us, both in the way we are taught and the things that we are taught and the way that we compete against each other in first and second grade already, that by the time a kid graduates elementary school, it's no longer a kid, it's a little adult. Think of what we put our mitzvah boys through. Think of the demands that we typically make of a 12 or 13-year-old kid, or at least I'm thinking of my own experience. And it's time to say, I'll say that we really, really prevent. Think of the structuring that goes on in lots and lots of schools in which kids are taught to color in a particular way, or the answers all have to match a certain formality. And if the child part of the personality survives at all, it's not because of, but in many cases, despite the kind of very rigorous training that is typical of yeshivas. Please.
Please.
You also have the fact that
we
train our children, and we as adults are raised that way, with the need to avoid expressing any kind of feeling or emotion.
Mm-hmm. Not appropriate.
Good little boy. Stop making all that noise and we're going to hold the davening until, and we're not going to continue with the lemon. I would be embarrassed to say that to my teenagers. Certainly would not.
We're going to punish you by bringing down the wrath of the rest of the congregation on you because it's going to be a late service.
It's a very crucial question.
So what kind of adult response?
An adult response? More than an adult response? The shul is too large, and we should stop having 800 people on the shul, 400 or 500 people on the shul. The davening is too long. I mean, we have to at least ask those questions. What are the reasons that people talk in shul? When you get 400 people together for 2 or 3 hours, they want to talk. Want to have it. Those are adult responses. Not popular. I'm not advocating.
I'm off in the wrong direction. So I would assume that they're in the child mode. They're being, they're being mischievous. They're late, right?
That's
they're
one part.
They're being emotional. They're being fun-loving.
Right.
So maybe if the rabbi responded in their mode and went over and put their arm around and say, Frank,
okay,
you know what? I'd love to get a joke. You come over later. Have a joke with me.
Just listen to that for a second. Does that sound childish?
No, they...
It still sounds like a parent.
No, I don't know. You're putting your arm around them. You're not saying, I need quiet here because this service can't go on.
That's even more for it.
Maybe for adults, you've been childlike, but it's different than standing at the beam and saying, we'll not continue with that section quiet
absolutely.
Down.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Follow up and then there's some
lines of different kinds of parents and children.
Continue.
Now, for example, there is a nurturing adult. There's a nurturing parent. You're speaking of nurturing parents. You're talking about, oh, I'm a good boy, and I love you. Just talk a little less. Let's talk a little bit. But then there's the vindictive adult. He's a good parent. You're either the finger.
Go ahead, jump in.
You mentioned before the spirituality being part of the child as well. Perhaps the talking is the wrong child. Leave the room or be quiet or waiting. We're focusing on the wrong half of the child.
Okay. And if we can get something that will engage the child in a positive response, and that's an adult kind of approach to this question. But, you know, Mark's point, which is well taken, there may not be an adult response on the moment. It may not be. The whole point is that the adult will have thought through. The other thing that... So I say we're reaching toward what may have been a fringe rather than the mainstream, which may be much more a question of halacha and mitzvahs maaseus. That may be our response to spirituality, which is not the mainstream kind of issue that's being raised today. People want, I don't know, something that sounds almost like a Quaker or a hoedown, black church kind of response. You know, people yelling and screaming and jumping and so forth, which there may have been room for that, but I'm not sure that that was the mainstream of the way Jews expressed their spirituality. I want to be cautious about not getting caught up in that. Rav Moshe, are you the chair? Somebody's going to throw me out of here, ain't they?
I'm just the check and balance of putting together your response to Mark's reaction. So if that's the adult reaction to go ahead and to look for alternatives, and not sticking to the parent mode, not moving out of the room, not moving out, just leaving you locked.
Yeah.
And so the process becomes one where the rug has to be one of the people.
And then you end up being parental, even though that's not the way you want to be. Right. Or your president ends up being one. Or you elect somebody president who does that.
Okay. But if the issue is, then I have to be creative enough to open up some of the other alternatives.
And it's either parental of us or childish of us that we're unwilling even to ask the question of maybe there's something wrong either with the shul or the way we have structured or the length of the davening or the approach, whatever we call davening, that simply doesn't allow for the kind of quiet. And that's why I had a long talk with Irv Levitz, who's an old buddy of mine, before he did. He showed me the manuscript of that article that ultimately was published in the OU Publishers and so forth. And I had some real trouble with it because it once again, in a very parental fashion, laid all of the responsibility on the individual, Ms. Powellim, and all right, so you're not bad, so there are psychological needs that you're expressing. But one way or the other, it's your job to try and work out of it, and it's your lack of discipline, and it's your psychological hang-ups. Maybe not. Please.
It could backfire. The rabbi I grew up with actually had a lot of young people, and he used to tend to go on in his sermon, and, you know, they used to stand in the back and talk.
Yep.
But he got up and he said, look, all you people who come here don't want to take it. I'm not interested enough for you to leave me. Well,
that's exactly, that's the worst parental, it's a nightmare. It's just like telling you, oh, yeah, well, here's the keys to the car. Go out. I don't care. And he goes out.
The humor helps. I know my husband usually was pretty much very quiet, but you have one or two talkers. They phone book fit among them, and they thought that was very fun.
Interesting. Very interesting. Let me call your attention to one summary page here, and then I know I'm way over. Again, the assumption is that one should spend about two-thirds of his or her time in the adult. That means that the remaining 40% is divided approximately between being parental and being childlike. Now, those are terrible, gross generalizations. The answer is that when it's appropriate to be in the child, that's when it's appropriate to be in the child. And you should be able, with certain people, you may be 100% childlike. It's the only way to reach them. Salespeople know very well, and the equivalent in your field is fundraising, personal solicitation, know very well that there are some people that will only be reached by being childlike and, you know, and listening to jokes from them that are offensive and that you really shouldn't be subjected to, that should never be said to a rabbi, and you sit there and you laugh and you have a drink with him and you be his buddy because he's going to write out a big check. Or to be parental, there are certain people who need to get yelled at, who want to feel guilty that they didn't give enough money, who want to feel guilty that they're not memorializing their parents in a variety of different ways. A lot of that is changing though nowadays. Fewer and fewer people are willing to do that. More and more fundraising is moving toward an adult-child kind of relationship in which people want to feel that they're accountable and that they have their program, they're part of what's going on. Let me call your attention. I'm just out of time, and I apologize. I should have been better at managing my time. We should have been better at starting our time. The page following, and there's a lot of other stuff in there. Yeah, we're massaging the child. Working hard to bring out the adult in others. It's not just that you have to be in the adult, but if you want to have a team that you can work with that is intelligent, that is thoughtful, that calculates, then you have to encourage that kind of behavior, and you have to reward that kind of behavior in other people. Using the parent when others need nurturing. How do you know when he needs nurturing? You got to know. Those are your skills. Using the parent when others need structure. There are times when the chevra needs to know that davening begins at 7 o'clock, period. And we begin at 7:01, we're already saying brachas. People need structure. There is room for that sort of thing. Using the parent when others need occasional discipline. Every once in a while, there is absolutely nothing wrong with the rav or the rav's lieutenant getting up and saying, chevra, it's just too darn noisy here. They're waiting for you to do it. And when you don't, just like a teenager waits for a parent, absence of structure, so we take advantage of that. Operating from the child when others need to laugh. Operating from the child when others need to take risks. Yeah, there's a lot of things that if we keep doing the same business over and over again, we're going to be out of business. We've got to take risks. We've got to make change. Change is scary. You've got to make it fun. There's got to be something in it for the child. There's got to be some kind of quick win that you can get, and there's got to be a pizza party after. It sounds like the stuff you do with teenagers. That's right. 100%. Operating the child when others need creativity. My friends at LEAD know that we learn creativity exercises. The idea being that people need permission to be silly. You know, even though we're talking about childlike attitudes, lots of people can't do it anymore. They don't know how to be childlike anymore. We have to create environments and structures in which people can be silly and do things that and then they come up with brilliant ideas that they never would have been able to have had they not been unleashed. Gentlemen and ladies, there's a great deal more to say. This barely scratches the surface. I want to thank the folks who put together the conference very much for inviting me, giving me the opportunity to spend time with you. And I just wish them we'll have a chance in the future. Thank you. Handing over me that way.
Yeah. Not taking that. My parents' position. I'll be trying. It's very important that we try and recapture it in less time. There's a new problem immediately, then we're going to try and create a small capital of the smellers for women's session. It's going to be taking place with Rebbetzin Ryback with women, and then we'll follow that with Rabbi Willis. session. Please, we'll try and have her when we can. And keep everything moving. Ashley, you're really tough. I'll give you a hug.